On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we debrief our visit to the California Association meeting in Huntington Beach, California several weeks ago, interview William Eisenberg, Vice President of Patient Safety at Sutter Health, and discuss patient safety, incident reporting, and the importance of reporting near misses, and answer questions about deemed status surveys.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a biweekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 36 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Monday, September 17th, 2018, recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey. He is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry and the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry. John is a nationally known speaker and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So, John, we've had, again, a busy few weeks.
Yes, indeed. As we always seem to have a busy few weeks, we had the honor of attending the California Ambulatory Surgery Association conference in Huntington Beach a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it was beautiful there.
It was wonderful. And we did a special episode. That's episode 35. If you're from California or if you want to learn about what's going on in California or you just want to hear about the conference. And then, Sue, we took a day off and visited Long Beach there.
Yep. We took a whale watching boat.
Right. Out.
And we didn't see any whales, but we saw some dolphins, and it was amazing.
It was incredible. It was a pod of a couple hundred of them.
I bet.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah, they were all over, and there was one mom and baby that kept swimming around just under the surface of the water, and they were, other ones were jumping out of the water and
doing acrobatics.
And it was really cool.
It was well worth it. So thank you, California Association, for inviting us out there, and we certainly made the most of those 2 days. And then this last week, I did a survey for one of the accrediting organizations. It was a two-day survey. That was fun. And I did a deposition as an expert witness for a medical malpractice case, which is always an interesting thing to do. And then we're still working on opening a new center up in upstate New York. That's keeping much of our team very busy right now. We're getting pretty close. We hopefully will be open that in another month or so. And we've hired a new employee.
Yep.
So here we go. Yep. We're adding an average of one employee every.
Yep, we're very excited about that.
So we're hoping that all of our listeners in North and South Carolina are safe, and we're praying for a quick recovery from Hurricane Florence. Sue and I spend time every year at our timeshare near North Myrtle Beach, so we know the area very well, and unfortunately our timeshare is right in the area there, so right in the area of the storm, so we'll see how it recovers from it.
It's a beautiful area, so I really hope that it makes it through. And I think this just points up the importance of disaster planning and recovery planning, because, you know, these things happen.
Exactly. You know, and so the governor, at least in South Carolina, I haven't followed necessarily North Carolina quite as well, but in South Carolina, they closed all the healthcare facilities along the coast there. Ambulatory surgery centers were told to shut down until further notice. And I think, as you mentioned, we talk about disaster preparedness, but just as important as dealing with the disaster is the recovery afterwards. And I think that's what everyone in South Carolina and the surgery centers are going to be dealing with as they go back to their centers and see what damage has been sustained and try to figure out how they get back into business. You know, back in the 90s, I was running a surgery center in Rochester, New York, and we had a major ice storm, which resulted in major power outages. And most of our employees and the surgery center was without power for, you know, 3 days to, some people were still without power a week later, or 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And you really need to prepare for that to be able to determine how do you keep these people busy? What do you do? Do you continue to pay the employees as they, even though the business is not operating? You also have to make sure you have proper insurance to cover, you know, loss of business during that time. Mm-hmm. So again, always another reason to make sure you're on top of disaster planning.
Yeah. And the recovery part that you're talking about, I think that one center that we worked with for a short time, they had a small fire, I think,
that's
in
right.
the center. And then because of all of
Delaware.
The, they ended up with some flooding from the sprinkler system. So it's important to think past that first obvious thing.
Right.
And how do you get back from that? And what are some of the ramifications that could happen
right.
from any incident?
Yeah. And I believe that that's also the place that had the problem that the C-arm failed even after mm-hmm. it had been repaired after the damage that had occurred, which caused further problems for, mm-hmm. for their recovery. And this week, we're heading out to Ohio to the Ohio State Association Conference. This is the Ohio Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers. It's on Wednesday and Thursday of this coming week. Conference runs from September 18th to the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio. If you want more information, visit their website at www.oaasc.net. And we're going to be doing a special episode from the conference and talk to the association leaders about what's going on in Ohio.
Yep, and this is our 20th annual conference, by the way.
That's right. And a reason to celebrate. Not, mm-hmm. Most of us in surgery center industry always find some reason to celebrate. Sue, you studied the conference agenda. Can you mention a few highlights?
Sure. I always love looking these things over because I find most of the sessions pretty interesting. But especially as a nurse, I'm really looking forward to Thursday's general session, which is Compassion Fatigue, The Other Side of the Stethoscope by Amy D. She's an RN and a motivational speaker, so that should be really good. Also, Stephen Foss will have a session on Wednesday about emergency preparedness. And Bill Lindemann presents Thursday on addressing common life safety citations from CMS and Ohio Department of Health, which I'm sure a lot of that can apply to anywhere. And I don't know, there's some regulatory guy who's doing a session on Thursday on governance. Do you know anything about
that? Yeah, very funny. Yeah, my session will be on governance. It'll be on Thursday afternoon, and it's called Governance, a Guide for Administrators. And the description says, what do Ohio administrators need to know about what their governing bodies are required to do? This session will provide a detailed review of all you need to know to ensure a well-functioning governing board. We'd love to see and talk to all of our listeners out there in Ohio at the conference, so don't hesitate to stop us and say hi. Let's take a short break and we'll do a focus segment on incident reporting, patient safety, and have an interview with Dr. Eisenberg.
And in this episode's focus segment, we're going to talk about incident reporting and reporting all types of occurrences, incidents, adverse events, and near misses, as this is frequently a problem, especially with new or minimally compliant ASCs.
Yeah, so one of the things that we find as we go into one of our newer clients or a center that is about to open is that the employees and the leadership of the organization don't always understand the importance of incident reporting, of tracking incidents, mm-hmm. occurrences, whatever level, adverse events, et cetera, near misses. And this is frequently a pretty important problem because certainly from a survey standpoint, from an accreditation standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, one of the main things that we use as a basis of quality improvement mm-hmm. and risk management is those incident reports. So if you don't have any incidents mm-hmm. and you don't report any incidents, first of all, nobody's going to believe you because obviously things go wrong anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing that I've heard over and over from you is that, you know, not having any is not a good thing.
No.
I think a lot of people starting out feel like, well, you know, we want to seem like we're doing everything right, but
right.
nobody can, and you need to learn from these incidents.
Right. I think I've told the story of a number of years ago. I had a brand new client, no longer a client, by the way, who during the surveyor asked the nurse manager for a list of all the incidents that they had in the last 3 years. And the nurse manager, who was kind of a little full of himself, said, sir, we are a high-quality organization. We never have any incidents here. And the surveyor, who was a friend of mine, came back and he was kind of red-faced and he came back and said, well, then, sir, you're lying to me. And I'll never forget that incident. I'll never forget that mm-hmm. That situation. And really, it was a learning experience for everybody in the room there, the importance of doing this and that. And that they really won't believe you if you tell them that there mm-hmm. are no incidents during the time. So What's important here is that we have a good incident reporting system and that we teach employees and physicians the importance of incident reporting and near miss reporting also. So even though we get to a point and we determine that we're about to do something, you know, surgery on the wrong limb or the wrong section, or we have the wrong patient in the room, or we have the wrong implant that we're about to put in, it's important to report that as an incident report, as a near miss, so that we can learn from it and hopefully back up to a prior step so that maybe we don't get to that point where it became a near miss. Mm-hmm. So even we should praise the people that caught it mm-hmm. at the same time that we go in and investigate mm-hmm. how to back that situation up another step so that we can possibly avoid it in the future. And that really is the focus of an interview that we did at the CASA annual conference in Huntington Beach several weeks ago, where we interviewed William Eisenberg, who is an MD, PhD, and he's the Vice President of Patient Safety at Sutter Health from San Francisco, California. So I thought, Sue, let's listen to his interview here, mm-hmm. and then we'll talk a little bit about it afterwards.
Okay.
So we're here at the CASA annual conference in Huntington Beach, California, and we're here with Dr. William Eisenberg, who is doing a speech shortly on, am I running an ambulatory surgery center or a nuclear power plant? High reliability principles come to healthcare. Dr. Eisenberg, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist by training, and I've been heavily involved during my years as a practicing OBGYN department chair, chief of staff at the facilities where I worked, in pursuing everything possible to keep our patients safer. And so we did a lot of things around implementation of strategies to keep every doctor and every nurse on the same page. We did lots of simulations because, frankly, you don't want to be learning how to avoid a bad outcome in real time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's much better when you can do that through practice.
Right. Drill, drill, drill.
Drill, drill, drill.
Yep. And then figure out what you could have done differently.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. And so it was pretty innovative at the time. This was practically a decade ago that we rolled this out at my facility in Sutter Health. But it really caught on. And now the university that is adjacent to several of our facilities has bought into it, and we have whole simulation centers. We've made it mandatory for our physicians and nurses to participate in these for their privileges. And it has been really remarkably good.
So you're largely working in a hospital environment here with Sutter Health, but you do have some outpatient surgeries.
Yeah, so my work there was in hospital. However, 3 years ago, I transitioned into my new role at Sutter, and I'm the Vice President of Patient Safety. Mm-hmm. So in that role, I oversee hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, our ambulatory service, and our Sutter Care at Home. So ASCs have become a big part of my oversight now from a safety perspective. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we've been pursuing the rollout of high reliability, not only in our hospitals, but in fact, across our company. And not only in the clinical settings, but frankly, for everybody. Because the things we teach in high reliability are beneficial to any worker. I mean, we don't want people executing contracts in our legal department and not having second sets of eyes on them.
Yeah.
Or not having a staff member who's doing something pretty minor in a contract say, you know what? I don't feel good about this.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So these strategies and these error prevention tools, pretty much the part and parcel of what high reliability is all about, uh-huh. how airlines are so extraordinarily safe, these are things that we can all use.
Right.
And frankly, they're so useful in an ambulatory surgery center where the volume is high, the turnover is rapid, and so we really have to be focused on every time we do the same thing.
Right.
You do it predictably well, regardless of whether suddenly there's a fire in your backyard because you live in Lake County.
Yeah.
Right.
So these kinds of strategies that we're working with our entire workforce, doctors, nurses, everybody, are so powerful and so beneficial.
This is more hospital-based, my comment, but just because you are in OBGYN, I know, John, you were surprised when you'd started seeing articles about how we're losing more mothers. We focus so much on baby care,
right.
and
yes.
all of a sudden our percentages of moms who are getting preeclampsia or, you know, and not being treated. So like you said, just always focusing on every time and really learning what can be going wrong and practicing and being ready for those times.
Absolutely. Thinking about what could go wrong, we call it in the high reliability space, preoccupation with failure. And I don't like people to get confused and think that, you know, we're always walking around with sad faces and bummed out. No, that's not it at all. It's that we're always thinking about what could go wrong, being ready for it, having a plan B. And, you know, I don't use plan B just because I'm a gynecologist and that's a prescription I write. Plan B is something that I think as any practitioner, it's always wise to have in your back pocket. You just, you know, when you're dealing with a human being, you just never know what could go awry.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've probably had a real challenge in taking it from, I mean, these principles, of course, work pretty well or probably translate well into the hospital environment where you have a lot more resources than you have in the ASC. What have been your, what has been some of the challenges you've had in translating that into the ASC market?
Yeah. So I think culture, in my estimation, I've worked in an ASC a lot when I was actively practicing. The culture of that particular space is what makes it or breaks it.
Right.
So the culture in the individual facility, the closeness of those staff members is critically important. To be successful in high reliability, it requires a culture change. And so sometimes the culture of every person feeling empowered to speak up, everybody being willing to stop the line, bumps into the culture of the organization. And I would have to say that's been the biggest challenge for me. It's one thing in a hospital where you've got 500 to 1,500 employees. It's another thing when you're going into an ASC that may have 20 to 50 employees. And they have a really entrenched way of doing their work that works for them.
And they tend to be focused a little bit more on speed than they do in the hospital.
And always having somebody that's willing to back up those nurses or anybody else who might bring it up and say, you know, I'm concerned about this.
Right.
And even if they're wrong, welcoming that intervention.
Yes.
Just in case, you know, the next time they might stop something that could happen.
Right. It's just think about it. If we end up, number one, putting our nursing staff in the role of being the sheriff in town, that they have to police the situation, that's awkward.
Right?
That really flies right in the face of camaraderie. And if you don't respond to a suggestion from a nurse, if you just sort of blow it off and say, no, that's not accurate, or the count, of course, is right. You know, you just miscounted. There's nothing in there. We had a great recent case after the training had been instituted. We had three nurses in the room, and this was in an ambulatory surgery center, a pretty much small case that had to minor incision, so they opened the abdomen, finished the case, and the count was off. Three nurses happened to be in the room because there was somebody being trained, so they actually had multiple nurses. And the doctor said, no, we're sure you miscounted, right? So they did their protocol. They did an x-ray. Radiology did a quick read. Nope, nothing there. Put the films up in the room. Surgeon, assistant surgeon, anesthesiologist all looked at it. Nope, nothing here. You must be off on your count. The nurses were clear. You know, they said, nope, the count is not accurate. The surgeon said, well, you know what? I respect you. I trust you. That's what we've been talking about in all of our training. Let me look again. Reached up way under the diaphragm in an area that hadn't been imaged on the x-ray, and there was a sponge.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, we celebrate those nurses.
Right.
We and the doctors who are going to listen.
And
to
the
them.
Doctors who listened, of course. And we don't stop there, right? Because what did that point out? It pointed out that there was a process step that put that worker at risk, right? And so what we needed to do is be sure that our fields, when we take our x-rays, are covering the entire abdomen, right? So if we just stop with the congratulations of the people involved in the event, we haven't dug deeply enough to understand what the base problem was.
I love that story because it's truly the definition of a quality improvement program where you don't stop just by saying, hey, good job, good everybody. You caught it. You try to go back to what caused that to fail in the first
place. And that's one of the other characteristics of a high reliability organization, you know, reluctance to simplify, right? The five whys, keep asking, why did it happen?
Right.
Why didn't they see it on the x-ray?
Interesting.
So you chose a great title. I've been saying this in the podcast leading up to the episode here. Am I running an ambulatory surgery center, a nuclear power plant? So tell me how you chose that title and how it relates to this topic.
Well, you know, I think I want it to be provocative. You certainly want to have people come to your talk if you prepared one, right?
And I'm learning a lesson. Maybe I got to make my titles more interesting too.
But I also, you know, as I roll this out, I was sharing with others recently that I get a lot of pushback from my colleague physicians and nurses. Oh, come on, Bill. This isn't really the same thing as flying an airplane or running a nuclear reactor. And I'm thinking, well, okay, is it complex and high risk? Yes.
Yeah.
Is what we do meet those criteria? Mm-hmm. Is it as complicated as trying to land a fighter jet on the deck of a boat in the middle of the ocean at night? I think so, you know. And yet we've got young people that may have never even been to college doing those tasks,
right,
running nuclear reactors. We've got pretty much guys that are just out of their teens doing that successfully. And yet we still make medical errors with far more frequency than we should be.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that if we could draw some parallels between how other endeavors, human endeavors that are fraught with risk, are still able to be accomplished safely, mm-hmm, time after time after time, we ought to be thinking about learning those same lessons and looking at our roles as leaders of ASCs to be analogous. So that's where I got the title.
Wonderful. So when you do speak, what are going to be your takeaways? What do you hope your audience is going to take away? Are there some quick little suggestions that you're giving them to start off with?
Well, I'd like them to understand, you know, what the characteristics of a high reliability organization are, and how, in my mind, they can be best understood in the context of an ambulatory surgery center. I want to give them some examples, some real life examples that have happened at our organization, and most recently a very personal one that happened to a family member of mine at another healthcare organization, so that people understand the ramifications of these and how the decision making that resulted in the harm was flawed. And it's easy for us to see, mm-hmm, as we look at it in retrospectoscope view. But it may not have been that apparent in real life.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
At the end, I want people to understand, if I'm successful, that I think high reliability and keeping our patients and our staff safe works with joy in work as sort of a motive engine, mm-hmm, that then drives a larger virtuous cycle, so that when people feel safe at work and feel that they're keeping their patients safe, their confidence and their joy in their job every day is going to go up, and that's going to keep fueling it. If you don't do that, when people are making mistakes, their joy in work plummets.
Right.
And, you know, when they're making mistakes, when they're not satisfied and feeling burnt out, boy, the mistakes skyrocket.
Right.
Yeah.
When we have that cycle primed, then we start seeing enhanced quality results. We start seeing better patient satisfaction scores, and then we're really able to deal with organizational improvement. So I see that cycle that high reliability actually benefits every pillar that we look at. It's not just keeping our patients safe. It's actually enhancing their pleasure in their work every day. It's meeting our quality goals. It's meeting our affordability goals because we don't have lawsuits that we're defending. And our patients feel that they're getting the care that they come to us for. Nobody comes in to see a healthcare professional with the expectation that they're going to be harmed in the process.
Right.
We may not be able to cure everybody, but we certainly ought to be able to not hurt people.
Right. They need to leave in at least the same condition, hopefully much better
Right. And that's, you know, one of the things that is so, for me, remarkable just in my own personal history is how much more we're doing in the ambulatory surgery space.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's important for all of us that lead in that area to actually try and be extra safe, because now we're doing things that when I was in training, I mean, contemplating doing a full hysterectomy in an ambulatory surgery center and sending the woman home the same day, unreal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was, well, you're really going to do that tubal ligation with a laparoscope?
Right.
That was kind of as far as we got. And now, you know, I'm regularly doing full hysterectomies. Yeah.
It seems to me that, especially with the focus on the industry, we've had some bad press lately. You know, USA Today articles have kind of hammered the industry a little bit. And we know in the industry that a lot of those are just misleading articles. But it seems to me like your story, your message here is important for us to remember, because we are our own worst enemies. If we're not publicizing the fact that we're doing such great work,
yes,
and if we're not demonstrating this high reliability concept in everything we do, including documenting it as part of our quality improvement and our risk management programs, you know, we're setting ourselves up for these types of articles to proliferate in the future. And of course, to have these stories that the press come on top of. So it sounds to me like you've got a good message for them, and hopefully that will help them to provide a mechanism for demonstrating the quality of care that we're rendering.
You know, I think that's a really good point. And in fact, we want to be as transparent as possible about these efforts with our patients,
yeah,
and engage them in this process as well. Mm-hmm. If we're doing a timeout and we don't involve the patient, I mean, it's not like the kinds of operations we do in ambulatory surgery centers aren't people that are on respirators and, mm-hmm, you know, intubated, yeah, and can't participate. Yeah. Ideally, they can and they should. And the more we say, we're doing this because it's so important to us that we keep you safe.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and if you see anything at all, tell us about it. If somebody comes in to start your IV and she doesn't wash her hands first, tell us. If your anesthesiologist comes in and he doesn't wash his hands before he examines you, tell us.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Because that's how we learn.
I think that's great. I love that, especially your message that from the patients, the staff, the nurses, the doctors, the more buy-in and the more responsible they feel for everything, the happier they're going to be. Then it's all just a big cycle that improves the care. And when they have that expectation of excellence and, you know, are respected and listened to when they have questions or concerns, I think that's a really great takeaway point.
Because yeah,
it really matters when people are able to feel like they make a difference.
Sure. Well, and you know, I'll be telling a story during the course of the talk, but I was on a flight down to San Diego. I live in San Francisco, and I was on a flight down to San Diego a few months back for a board meeting, and got on the plane in San Francisco, ready to take off. And the pilot announced overhead he was going to be doing all of the stuff that the bursar normally does. And he said, so everybody, just be sure that your tray tables and seats are in their fastened position and your seat belts are locked. And then he went on to say, and the weather in San Francisco when we arrive is expected to be 75 degrees and we're ready for takeoff. Well, I'm sitting there and, you know, and I'm a high reliability guy and I'm a physician and I'm thinking, oh my God, is this guy having like a TIA or a stroke, right? Meanwhile, I'm holding onto the armrest as hard as I possibly can. Well, I was sitting fairly close to the front, and right away on a short flight like this, they're there with the beverage service almost instantly. Well, the bursar was taking care of my cabin, and I said, as she asked me whether, you know, what I wanted to drink, I said, I hate to say this, but, you know, I'm a physician, and the pilot just garbled the instructions, which all of us sort of know is a catechism, right?
Right.
and then he talked about the weather in San Francisco where we were going to be landing, and we're taking off from San Francisco. I just want to be sure he's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, she could have so easily just said, oh, I'm sure everything is fine, surgeon.
Right,
just sit
right
back, relax, and drink your diet soda.
Shut up.
No. She stopped.
Yeah.
She locked the cart. She walked to the front. She opened the door. She checked.
Wow.
Yeah.
She checked with him and she checked with a co-pilot. She came back to me and she said, thanks for pointing that out. You know, this is our, we do this milk run back and forth between SFO and San Diego.
Yeah.
He was on the wrong line on the sheet.
Yeah.
And he just read it wrong. It's been, you know, a long day. And this is our third flight back and forth. And so sorry about that, but he's totally fine and able to fly this plane.
Oh, good.
And I thought, gosh, see how easy that was.
Right.
See how I was honored as a reporter.
Yeah.
Right.
And yet it didn't take that much, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that difficult. Everybody was open to it.
Yeah.
Nobody got their hackles up that I know of. It's not like I got the evil eye from the pilot as I got off the plane.
Yeah.
And all I can think is, that's where I hope we all can be soon, so that everybody feels empowered to speak up, feels valued when they do, feels celebrated when they pointed out an opportunity for improvement.
Wonderful message, Dr. Eisenberg. I appreciate your time.
That's great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Probably taken up way too much of your time.
Oh, not at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was an excellent interview. I very much enjoyed speaking to Dr. Eisenberg. And it focuses on why we do this, why we continuously think about errors and try to plan for them. And Sue, you did quite a bit of investigation after the interview about the Swiss cheese model. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. So he had mentioned, as you said, the Swiss cheese model, and it just sounded pretty interesting to me. So I'd looked into that a bit. So it's by James Reason, and he used the name Swiss cheese model because he sees human and system errors as kind of holes in a safety net. And when the actual errors or damage or harm reaches the patient, that only happens when all these systems fail and human errors line up to kind of allow that error to get through.
Kind of like the holes in a Swiss cheese. If you put several slices of Swiss cheese together.
Yeah, you know, in a normal block, you would hope they don't line up, but they can line up just through several different errors. So the more you can put those blocks kind of in place, the less you'll see the errors. So I found an article in PubMed by this James Reason. It's named Human Error Models and Management About, and that's kind of about a Swiss cheese model of system accidents. He categorized errors into either human approach, which focuses on human error and blames the individual, or you can take a system approach, which focuses on work conditions and building in defenses and safeguards to kind of protect people when human errors do happen. The system approach recognizes that people are going to make mistakes. You know, none of us are going to be perfect. And while it is important to address those mistakes by depending on what the mistake is, whether you need to give more education, put new policies in place, or sometimes even disciplining the individual when that's what's required, the system approach looks further into the root of the problem, the root, you know, kind of that root cause analysis that we talk about, to find ways that you could build in defenses into the process, such as, say, medication scanning, equipment design, for example, using safety syringes to prevent needle sticks, anything you can do to take that human factor, human error out of the equation,
right?
You know, just to build in that safety. And I think it is a really important point because a lot of us, when you see an error done, you stop at that thought of, well, that person wasn't well enough educated, or they just weren't very smart. They did this, so, you know, you really want to blame the person. And he even noted in the article that we feel better about ourselves kind of when we can say, oh, well, you know, I would never have done that. That's just something they did. And while you can address those measures, a lot more effective way of doing it is to look back and see what could have stopped that. And I think bringing the people that either had the error, other people that work in that area where something happened, and really walk through those steps with them and see if anybody has any ideas of what you could put in place to stop that, you know, and focusing on what can happen. Like he says, the high reliability organizations focus on failure.
And they're not afraid to talk about it. And I think that's the important takeaway from hopefully this whole episode here and from the interview, is that it's healthy to actually look at those things that went wrong, to try to learn from them, to take them back to whatever steps need to be taken to, in order to try to avoid that situation in the past. And by a systems approach, what we're meaning here too is looking at all of the systems, including your hiring mechanism, you know, whether you brought the right people in, your credentialing mechanism, if it's a provider issue, peer review, all of those are things that are part of that systemic approach here to to assuring you have the right people in the right place, and that you've trained them appropriately, and that you have the right support systems for them. Okay, let's take a short break, and we'll come back with our last segment where we'll talk about a couple questions that we've been asked and finish with a discussion of upcoming events in the industry.
So, John, there is a lot going on with ambulatory healthcare strategies. Can you give our listeners an update on the company and its services?
Sure. Well, as you well know, we are growing fast. We now have 10 employees. You were number 9. We've since hired another summer intern, though I guess it's going to be a fall intern, actually, now. All of our employees are scattered throughout the East Coast with a cadre of independent consultants that we call upon when we need them. And probably one of the most exciting news that we had recently is Alex Bornham, and our director of operations and our go-to guy for life safety issues, passed his NFPA certification and became a CLSS-HC, which stands for Certified Life Safety Specialist for Healthcare. So we're now offering life safety surveys, which is something somewhat new to us, and are included in all of our retainers.
So what is a retainer?
So the core of our business is really retainer-based services. While we regularly help centers out with mock surveys, survey preparation, and post-survey mitigation, the core of what we do is make sure that you don't have to prepare for a survey or deal with the complex post-survey plans of correction. To that end, we have a regulatory compliance retainer, which is basically a way for centers to outsource quality improvement, risk management, infection control, emergency preparedness, and other CMS and accreditation oversight services.
And what is included in that retainer?
While all of our services can be tailored to the exact needs of the organization, our standard retainer includes either monthly or quarterly visits to the center, review of all quality improvement, risk management, infection control, and emergency services activities and documentation, preparation for attendance at and preparation of the minutes for the quality improvement meeting, the medical executive meeting, and the governing body meetings. Annual updates to the policy and procedure manual to comply with state CMS and accreditation requirements. We also prepare educational programs for orientation and annual mandatory education, and we can actually do those educational programs too if you wish. And of course, 24/7 access to me and my incredible staff for issues that might come up.
Well, that sounds expensive.
Well, I think the price might surprise many of our listeners. But the way you have to look at it is this: how can you afford not to? Many of our centers simply cannot afford or cannot find an administrator that has all of the education, training, experience to handle quality improvement, risk management, emergency services, and infection control. And our service allows centers to hire good MRFs managers that can focus on those things that they're best trained for, and we handle the rest.
So how do our listeners learn more about this?
Well, feel free to give me a call at 585-594-1167. That's 585-594-1167, or send us an email at info@ah-strategies.com. That's info@ahhealthcare-strategies.com.
So, John, we have a couple of questions. The first one is, what is the difference between deemed status and non-deemed status surveys? This seems to be a continual kind of confusion for people.
Right. And, you know, we talk about it in some of our previous episodes, but it's something we probably should just discuss periodically. Mm-hmm. So a deemed status survey is when you hire one of the accreditation organizations, such as AAHC or the Joint Commission, to do your survey for CMS purposes, which means that when they come out, they'll be doing not only an accreditation survey, but they'll be doing an unannounced CMS recertification survey to assure that you are still in compliance with the conditions for coverage. So those, as I said, are unannounced surveys, unlike announced surveys, which are what you would have with a non-deemed status survey. So I guess the question that we're often asked is, why would somebody do a deemed status survey, or why would they not do one? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, your state Department of Health does those surveys for free. So you would have to pay for a deemed status survey, mm-hmm. which on the face of it sounds like you'd probably better, you know, just to do a regular survey and let the state do your deemed status survey. But that means that you're going to be subjected to two surveys. And one of them will be any time during that 3-year period. With a deemed status accreditation survey, you're kind of going to know within a 6-month time frame when the survey is going to be. You won't be able to nail it down any further than 6 months, mm-hmm. but you'll be able to prepare a little bit better. You'll be on, you know, hopefully you're always prepared for a survey, but here you'll at least be able to assure that you're in your, you know, best behavior. Mm-hmm. Assure that you're best prepared for it during that 6-month time frame.
And
it,
a deemed status is done by AAHC, IMQ,
Joint Commission,
right. Any of those.
Exactly. So a regular accreditation survey is done voluntarily, really, because you want to show that you wish to go above and beyond the CMS conditions for coverage and demonstrate mm-hmm. a higher level of compliance with accreditation standards, just to kind of show that you're a little bit better quality than just the minimally compliant CMS organizations. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
So every week we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
The Ohio State Association meeting will be September 18th through the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio. We're going there this week. I think there's still time to sign up for it, and certainly say hi to us when you're at the conference.
The Virginia Ambulatory Surgery Association Fall Conference is at the Hilton Garden Inn, Virginia Beach, Oceanfront on September 20th.
The Indiana Federation of Ambulatory Surgery Centers 2018 Fall Conference and Trade Show is September 28th at the Ritz, Charles, and Carmel, Indiana.
The Pennsylvania Ambulatory Surgery Association annual meeting is October 1st at the Sheraton Harrisburg Hershey Hotel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
And we'll be there and we'll be doing a podcast from that conference. The OR Excellence 2018, sponsored by our friends at Outpatient Surgery Magazine, is October 3rd through the 5th, 2018, at the Harbor Beach Marriott Resort and Spa in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
The New York State Association of ASC's fall conference will be held at the Roosevelt Hotel on October 11th, 2018.
And the Roosevelt is in New York City, and we'll be there doing a podcast from there also. The 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium is November 2nd, 2018, at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square, and I think we are going to be doing a podcast from there. We're still working on that.
The CASA Infection Prevention Seminar is November 7th through 8th, 2018 in Costa Mesa.
The 2019 ASCA Winter Seminars are January 17th through the 19th in Austin, Texas at the Hilton Austin. The 2019 conference will include three tracks, ASC Management Essentials, Coding Update, and Reimbursement Strategies, and Infection Prevention Techniques in ASCs.
And ASCA 2019 will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through the 18th, 2019.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again next week for a special episode from the Ohio State Association meeting. And please, spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button. See you next week.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.